This episode of Farced Perspective is brought to you by Grepner's Elementary Piano Primers. If you're from a family of prodigies and really want to stick it to any of your offspring that may be so unlucky as to have fallen short of ethereal levels of talent, make them perform something from Grepner's. It's classy and demeaning.
Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me again is my co-host Anna, environmental scientist and analyst. Welcome back, Anna.
Thank you, Ben.
50 years ago today was the release of Five Easy Pieces, the first Bob Rafelson film released under his three-man specialty label, BBS Films, under Columbia. This film is talked about reverently. It's often talked about as part of the beginning of what became the O-Tourist movement. Now, eagle-eyed listeners may have noticed that the podcast is no longer referred to as The Python Perspective. We're now rebranded as Farced Perspective, an attempt at looking back at comedies on their 50-year anniversaries. This isn't really a comedy. I laughed a lot. And I want to talk about Rafelson's career as a comedy creator leading up to this. So let's dig into this a little bit. Anna, what were your active questions that you wanted to bring to the podcast today?
Well, I would say my first question is if you could maybe define auteur for some of our listeners who are not familiar with that word. I think that would be a generous way to start.
Okay. Auteurist movement in film criticism came out of, I believe, James Salas. I may have that name wrong, but I believe it's Salas.
This is Future Ben. James Salas wrote Drive, the novel that's the basis for the Ryan Gosling, Carey Mulligan movie. What past Ben meant was Andrew Saris, who helped popularize the concept of auteur theory. Sorry about that.
Who started to emphasize the idea that the director is the author of the film. The director is the person that brings a sensibility to it. So much of filmmaking is about choices. Somebody says, well, what watch is this guy wearing? What color should this shirt be? In the sound mix, do we want to de-emphasize this? And the director is the person who's always saying yes or no, or that needs to be different to things. The reason we talk about directors in general, that we look at films through the lens of, oh, let's look for through lines in Steven Spielberg's films. Let's look at a Tim Burton movie because I know it's going to have a certain atmosphere. It's going to have a certain taste because he's going to bring that to it, is born out of auteur theory.
Which was originating sort of in this era.
Absolutely.
With Five Easy Pieces.
Right. So Bob Rafelson, the director of this film, with his co-star Jack Nicholson, had previously written the screenplay for a movie called Head in 1968. And Head is the Monkees movie. You're familiar with the Monkees.
Yes.
Did you ever watch the television show?
I did not.
Or are you just familiar with Daydream Believer and their other bubblegum hits?
Well, I remember my dad talking about the Monkees and how okay. The Beatles, you know, people had some respect for the Beatles, even though they started out as kind of, you know, a little bit of a boy band. But the Monkees were ridiculous because it was just like this made up thing. But it was interesting reading a little bit about this director and sort of what he was up to. That it was like this very self-aware experiment. It was a conscious choice to play with this idea of creating something that was hyper palatable. And I really enjoyed sort of delving back into that history and seeing, like, oh, they knew exactly what they were up to.
So in preparation for this film, I rewatched Head. Since I knew we were going to be talking about the perspective of the germs of auteur theory, could I see anything from Rafelson that connected those two films together? I tried to watch Head in college and fell asleep during it because it really doesn't have a story to hang your hat on. unsurprisingly, a wild, choppy, television-inflected satire of popular culture, really isn't interested in a complete narrative through line and is more interested in just sort of throwing stuff at the line. Now, why I love Naked Gun 2.5, The Smell of Fear, and Airplane! exclamation mark, and yet somehow, despite my best intentions, really wanting to like Head, watched it twice, first in college and then several years later, and could not make it through either time without absolutely falling asleep. And so I was a little worried this time round that I was once again going to conk out, but instead was able to finally see it in its entirety.
So did you find what you were looking for? Did you see this sort of like common thread of the auteur in Head and then Easy Rider and Five Easy Pieces?
Well, let's point out, let's be clear, I want to hear you talk about Easy Rider, but Easy Rider was not directed by
Rafelson. Yes, that's right. But he produced it, right? He's like an uncredited producer.
It was made by his studio. So BBS, of which he was one third, gave Hopper the money to go off and film it and tried to rein him in and control things. Peter Fonda, I believe, is the actual producer of the film. He and Hopper generated the idea together and worked on the script, and then that was the power dynamic, at least according to Easy Rider's Raging Bulls by Peter Biskind, that dynamic between the two of them trying to figure out what the film was as they filmed it and as they edited it was largely a conversation or an argument focused around Fonda, particularly, trying to create some sort of shape out of that. But the money came from BBS.
And this same director of photography, no?
Laszlo Kovacs, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was the person who created the astonishing backlit vistas that show up in the clear blue skies of Five Easy Pieces. Yep.
I think that that is probably an important element of the success of both of these movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I found in Head was less of a directorial style, but the beginning of a company of players. Mm. So in Five Easy Pieces, there's an extended sequence with two hitchhikers that our main characters, Bobby and Rayette, pick up on the side of the road. And they're astonishing. One is named Terry Gross, which makes me incredibly happy. Because as somebody who has listened to an enormous amount of Fresh Air, that this crazy woman on the side of the road is also named that. And then both Tony Basil and Helena, whose last name is long in Greek, and I want to get it correct because it's a great last name, Kelianiotis, both of whom were dancers in Head.
Oh.
And were acquaintances of, particularly Helena, was a good friend of the screenwriter, Carol Eastman. And Eastman had been a friend of Nicholson's since he started taking acting lessons in 1957. So Nicholson is a screenwriter on Head because he's trying to write films because he's given up trying to act in films. He's been a day player. He's been in terrible monster movies. He's in the original Corman version of Little Shop of Horrors before they turned it into a musical. He's done westerns. He's done mob movies. He's done everything, and he can't get a good role. He started writing movies hoping that would help him get it. Carol Eastman wrote a movie a couple of years before called The Shooting that Nicholson plays a part in, but that's not why she gets hired by Rafelson, because he, in interviews, has said that he didn't know that Nicholson and Eastman were pals, that he found her independently. So you start to get this strange interconnected company of all these people who've worked with each other, who've known with each other, who've acted together, who've hung out. And so you start to see these people pop up again. When we talked in MASH about one of the fun things about MASH is that those people come back in McCabe and Mrs. Miller. And you get to see, when you watch a lot of Altman films, these people play wildly different roles, as Altman wants them to be in his movies, but also they want to be actors. And so they don't just play the same kind of character. It really shows their range. I don't know if that's the case in the breadth of the BBS role, but I do get this sense that they wanted to make movies, were kind of being prevented from making movies that they wanted to make. And so they just said, screw it, we're going to do this on our own. We're going to write and direct and produce. And if we can get somebody like BBS to give us a couple $100,000, then we'll just go and do something and we'll figure it out.
How much was the budget?
The initial payment for Easy Rider to go to New Orleans and start filming was, and I'm not going to be able to find this page quickly, something like $50,000. But in general, the producing philosophy of BBS Pictures was, as long as it doesn't cost more than $1 million, you can film whatever you want with no studio interference. Mm-hmm. The main producer, Bert Schneider of BBS, had final edit on any picture. He was the person that said, if we want to release this through Columbia, I get to be able to turn it into something that is hopefully successfully commercial. BBS's contract with Columbia was they needed to produce 6 movies for under $1 million each. Because Columbia was desperate to get involved in this new emerging trend of anarchic cinema that was inspired by things like Bonnie and Clyde and MASH and The Graduate, that was speaking to a youth culture that they didn't understand. And so they wanted these young people, all about the age of 35. So not quite as young as the college students and hippies and people that they were trying to get to go to the theaters, but still more in touch than the people who ran the Hollywood studios, who were oftentimes literally in their 90s. I'm now just paging through Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, having things jump out at me, but none of it is the money itself.
This issue about the budget, I think, actually is really interesting. It makes a lot of sense in terms of the feeling of the movies, sort of Five Easy Pieces. I think that on the first watch, I didn't exactly understand what that movie was about. But definitely Easy Rider, when I watched that, definitely it's a movie about wanting to destroy the confines of society, you know, and like it's, and I think that there's like a number of different ways that you can sort of read that when you're watching it. I don't know if you see them as heroes or anti-heroes or we're not here to talk about Easy Rider today, but
no, we are, because we're here to talk about how I think it's part of the context of understanding what Five Easy Pieces is.
Yes, I think so too.
The director, Dennis Hopper, you talk about, like, he was interested in creating a film that was about destroying things. There's a story that gets told by Polly Platt, who was the wife of the director, Peter Bogdanovich. And Bogdanovich was a huge fan of old Hollywood. He loved old Hollywood. One of the things he most enjoyed about his emerging film career, as far as I can tell, was that it gave him access to the power players of the films of the people that he grew up watching.
So what about Polly?
Thank you. Polly tells a story about Dennis Hopper being at a dinner party with George Cukor, who is a classic 40s director. If I'm not mistaken, directed The Philadelphia Story with Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart and Katharine Hepburn, and is, you know, one of the best romantic comedies of all time, despite the fact that it's a little bit weird that it opens with Cary Grant punching out Katharine Hepburn and then ends with the two of them getting remarried.
I think he sort of like pushes her down. I'm sure that she did worse.
Wow. Wow. Way to blame the victim, feminist.
No, she's not a victim. She's Katharine Hepburn. And that's one of my favorite movies. It's hard because it is one of my favorite movies, and it's hard for me to recommend it because there are some awkward parts of it for sure.
No, I am not yet willing to actually not love it. And so it's weird to me that anybody would be mean to George Cukor in a way that Hopper was, where he literally told him, we're going to destroy you. You're part of the old guard. We're coming for you. You deserve to burn. And Platt was just like, this is the height of crass rudeness, and I can't believe that this happened on our watch. The point of that whole sidebar.
I'm really excited to see if this makes it in.
Is that... Well, now that you've talked about it, we have to leave it in. Because there's nothing, nothing better in a podcast than somebody saying, well, this won't make the edit. That's what audiences love. That Hopper really was out on a mission to create a whole new form of cinema. He was angry with the edit of Easy Rider that got created by BBS. He thought that they cut the heart out of the incredibly weird thing that he was trying to accomplish. But BBS was a wing of Columbia Studios. And Biskin doesn't point this out explicitly. This is my own interpretation. But that they were interested in being financially successful. They were interested in creating a new kind of narrative, but a new kind of commercial narrative. And their goal was to be financially solvent and to make something that made money. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been involved in the kind of profit participation that they generated.
Well, that's an interesting twist. We have this like original idea that like, okay, like go forth, make any movie you want under $1 billion. And then here's the rub, like we're going to edit it. We're going to cut it up. I think that it's hard as the viewer, though, to know what is the voice of this sort of new generation or the new auteur, the movie maker, the director, or the writers, and what has been cut and put through the lens of the studio, you know, and what has been deemed palatable or cut and sliced to be profitable. I feel that way about a lot of media now, you know, where to some extent you might find something like sort of edgy and a takedown of something culturally, but at the same time, if it's produced by a, you know, a major media company, how edgy can it truly be? Like who is selling what and to whom and why? This is an old problem.
And it's part of the heart of head or part of the head of heart. One or the other. It's, but that movie is about, if it's about anything, deconstructing the message of television. Mm. But there's a marvelous scene in it where one of the monkeys punches out a woman in a diner. And then the woman takes her wig off and reveals that she's a stuntman who was there just to take a punch. But at the same time, the monkey pulls Nicholson and Rafelson on screen and says to them, this is supposed to be a kid's movie. The Monkees is a kid's television show. I'm not sure it works with our image for me to punch a lady. I think that we've done the wrong thing. And he goes off set and notices that because he's just punched this fake woman, everyone's sort of shuffling away from him and giving him the stink eye. And he's already done damage to his reputation by doing this. But obviously, this is being put on film. It's all fake. That kind of, we're showing the camera, but somebody is filming the fact that we're on camera means that there's yet another camera crew, is a gag that Monty Python has pulled a couple of different times. And it always makes me happy of the idea that you have to have a crew to shoot the crew.
Right.
To shoot the crew. In your movie within a movie within a movie is ridiculous, but it always means that it's never, never, never real. Mm. Which brings us to Five Easy Pieces. Is this a movie that has as its goal an attempt to show you something real? I mean, structurally, there's barely a story. It has an anti-ending, much like The Graduate. In that way, that it's it is an ending that is supposed to make you feel unsettled and a little bit hollow. You're not sure if you're supposed to like the protagonist, who's both incredibly charismatic and terrible as a person. What's going on with Five Easy Pieces? Why is it such an incredibly revered piece of cinema?
Well,
so you said you had to watch it twice before you were able to put a handle on what you thought about it. Can you talk a little bit about the first time that you watched it and what your responses were?
Yeah, I had to stop and start for my first full time through the movie because it was so offensive. And I think that a lot of modern viewers would probably have this experience, because the first probably like 20 or so minutes, I think, are really focused on the relationship between Bobby and Rayette, which is emotionally abusive, to say the least, I think.
Bobby Dupuis is an oil worker played by Jack Nicholson, and he is living with a waitress named Rayette, and they have what from the outside looks like a terrible relationship on every level. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, not from the outside.
Well, but I think from the inside is also interesting,
mm-hmm.
as to what the two characters want out of that relationship. So one of the things that comes up fairly early is that Rayette is threatening suicide to keep Nicholson's character with her.
You ever really get up and leave me, you read about in the newsprint.
I'm not gonna get up and leave you.
Yeah, no, it's not just abusive unidirectionally. It's very toxic. And it's an important plot element, because it, mm-hmm. it motivates his character to take her with him on this trip home to his family.
But one of the first things we see, so we have this montage over the credits with Tammy Wynette singing Stand By Your Man.
What a choice.
But one of the first interactions is that she is pressuring him to say to her that he loves her.
I'll go out with you, or I'll stay in with you, or I'll do anything that you like for me to do, if you will tell me that you love me.
And he is avoiding saying it as much as humanly possible. He doesn't want to be caught in a lie. She is incapable of saying what she really feels about this, and is therefore only lashing out emotionally by holding him hostage.
Mm-hmm.
Which we then cut to the bowling alley scene, and his good friend Elton from the oil refineries of Bakersfield and his wife, played by Fanny Flagg, author of Fried Green Tomatoes.
Oh, good connect.
Yeah. Let's point out, a book and film about women getting out of toxic relationships through murder. There's so much push and pull of genuine affection and genuine hatred. She gets on his last nerve very, very quickly and very easily.
Are you mad at me?
No, I'm not mad at you, honey. It'll be all right. We're not excited.
Look at me and tell me you're not mad at me.
I'm not mad at you.
Right. That she's happy and she's sweet and she just wants to love him. And she's just having a good time, and she's terrible at bowling. And for some reason, that is a hateable offense. And instead of affectionately accepting this shortcoming, you know, he finds every reason to hate her more. And she only wants to be loved by him specifically. For what reason, I can't fathom, because he's so cruel.
And he has genuine ties to her. Like, he can't escape something about her. When he has just hit on and been hit on by the two women bowling in the lane next to him, he then goes out to the car and says, come on, let's go and meet up with our friends.
They're just gonna think that I'm not too nice a guy, which I'm not, and that you're a real hell of a good person for putting up with me, that's all.
And is genuinely can't walk away and leave her there without trying to make her feel better, even though there's something about her that he can't stand.
But that's not what happens. What happens is she doesn't want to go hang out, and he's like, fine, stay here then.
He says, if you just sit there in the car, watch out or else somebody might hit on you.
And she says, maybe somebody will. And as he's walking away, he turns around and he says,
no one would want to hit on you. You look too pathetic.
It is so abusive. It is like the
and then he can't finish walking away. He has to go back and try and fix it.
Right. This is like such the classic core of like abuse, is like this emotionally punishing and then soothing. And he gets in the car with her and they kiss, and she's like, I'm going to kill myself, you know? And so, and she's got this toxic thing, you know, back with him, you know, and it's like, they're doing it together, and it's this whole this whole wrapped up thing, you know, and it was so hard to watch, especially on the tales of, like, you know, when he comes home in the first scene, you know, when she's sitting on the bathroom sink, it's adorable. She's like doing her makeup or something. She's so pretty. You know, she's like got this like little cross-eyed face. It's like, she's the cutest. And he looks in the bathroom, and he like rolls his eyes, you know, or like some kind of like Jack Nicholson equivalent. And he like turns away from the bathroom. What it is about her that is so offensive to him is unclear. Maybe it's his own self-loathing.
Yes, that this is the thing that emerges. I think you've absolutely put your thumb on it, and that it is it is his own self-hatred.
Yeah.
That he sees her and it reminds him of where he is and the choices that he's made to get there, and he hates it.
But she is so much more deserving of like a pure, true love, you know, and that she doesn't deserve to be treated that way. And
nobody deserves to be treated that way, but we don't know why. I think you're calling out of that moment of he walks into the bathroom, he sees her curled up on the sink, looking at herself in
the
mirror.
So
a thing
cute.
That he does several times in the movie as well.
Interesting.
And doesn't like what he sees every time he looks in the mirror. Very unhappy with what it represents. Sees her doing the same thing, is instantly angry about it, but we don't know why. Literally, your response is correct. Like, you don't know why that causes him to lash out. The rest of the movie is a slow reveal of why he is that person who doesn't love himself, doesn't think that he's worthy of love. And in fact, we never get the whole story, but we get an increasing amount of detail of his pathology. And we get two scenes right in a row. The fourth and third to last scenes in the movie are him talking with the Danish piano maven that's living at his house, Catherine Van Oost, where she tells him that you can't love somebody who doesn't think that he's worthy of love, that he is broken, and that she is not going to be the person that fixes him.
Right.
Which is all incredibly healthy things to say to somebody who is this screwed up.
Right, like she's the healthiest person in the movie.
And then he finally has the conversation with his father that his sister wants him to have. He's had a fight with Elton where he calls him
some cracker asshole, lives in a trailer park, compare his life to mine.
He's so much better than this, and we don't know what the grounding for that explosion is. We don't know why he's so above Elton, in his opinion, until we see him put on a suit and go find his sister, who's playing classical music in a recording studio, and we start to get this picture of where he's come from, that he is a person who's deliberately put being high class in his rearview mirror. But we don't know why until we finally have him have this conversation with his dad. Up until that point, we really have only been guessing based on behavior. Once we finally get those answers, then two more things happen. He says goodbye to his sister, and then he abandons everybody in a truck stop and goes north to Alaska on a lumber truck.
Did you feel like that was an effective, pivotal plot point where he's having this conversation with his dad? Because in terms of the of all the different scenes in the movie, I can barely even remember that, honestly. So I don't know if it's because of like who I am as a person and how I resonate with Bobby as a character, where that's just not even really on my radar. I'm like, yeah. And then he like said some stuff, but he was just such a mess. That particular scene did not stand out to me. But then I don't know if maybe if I felt like I was a man who had a relationship with my father that was really important to me, I might have a really different experience with that scene. So I don't know. Do you think that that's a way that people might have a different experience with this movie as a viewer?
Yes, I think some people would. I don't know if it's a masculine thing. I can tell you that on the Criterion Edition commentary, Rafelson says that he might have to turn away while he's recording the commentary from that scene because he's only watched it once when it was being filmed, and it was so emotionally raw and real to him that he's never been able to successfully watch it again.
Oh my gosh, I gotta rewatch it. That's incredible. What an incredible thing to say.
Right. I found it a little cliche.
Well, that's kind of what people sometimes say about this movie, is that it's a little bit like, maybe like, I don't know, melodramatic or like a little bit...
But I brought up George Cukor and the Philadelphia Story earlier, in part because I was thinking about the dramatic structure of this film. Philadelphia Story is a woman's about to get married. She gets drunk. She has a personal revelation about herself. And then she turns around and transforms her life the next day, even though it's the morning of her wedding. She turns everything around. She fixes everything. One of the things I like about Five Easy Pieces is Nicholson has this amazing emotional revelation, but still isn't ready to fix things, which to me is much more realistic. And I'm in favor of that kind of dramatic take on things, that you need to reflect that just because somebody has a realization doesn't mean they're going to change their life. Someone can hit rock bottom and still not get better. And that is a much more anti-dramatic and therefore emotionally powerful thing, because we want a person to learn. We want a person to improve themselves. We want a person to turn around. That's one of the things that drama has taught us, is that these are the things that transform us. And to then have that be an anticlimactic moment that then he runs from up to pure white Alaska.
Yeah, I think probably at the time, it felt really good. I think that when I was watching it, I felt a similar thing that I felt when I was watching Easy Rider, which is that it feels cliche because it is the source material for so much of what comes afterwards. Like, it is the essential mapping for the masculinity that drove so many young men you know, through the like 70s and 80s and, you know, and beyond, where I can still see how it has such a role to play in masculinity today. And that prototypical character that Jack Nicholson is playing in Five Easy Pieces, the loner who can't admit that he loves his girlfriend, who like puts her down because he hates himself, that style of person, whether or not it's because he's from a different background than the one he's living, or whatever his motivations are, I think that there were these characters developed during this era of cinema that defined an era of cool for many decades to come, and still are referred back to by young people developing their sense of self today.
I'm smirking because in MASH, one of the articles that we read said, this is awful because these people are providing terrible role models for culture and have been for the last 50 years. And you were like, no, they're sexy. They're great.
I just disagreed. I thought that those people were so cool. But if you watch doctors doing badass doctor things, you're not going to be like, those assholes, even if they are. If they're funny and they're brilliant, you know, if they're a little bad, being a little bad is cool and everyone knows that.
But a person just running away from his privilege and being so emotionally unreconstructed about it that he's just taking it out on everyone around him doesn't have the trauma of war or the life-saving abilities to be worthwhile.
No, I think that this character is really complicated, and I'm not sure who would watch this movie and think that this character is good.
Well, Rafelson did. Allow me to read you.
Oh my gosh. Okay, all right, let's hold that thought. Yes, tell me.
October 24th, 1970 in The New Yorker. There's a interview with Rafelson, and he says, I wanted to make a movie where I liked everyone in the movie. That was my privately stated task. Bobby, the hero, I love him. I couldn't have made the movie if I hadn't loved him.
Well, I think that this is really interesting and important, and I think that it speaks directly to this idea of how we're supposed to see this character. And, you know, if the director is looking at him lovingly and sort of holding him up as somebody to admire, I think that that's key. And I would say that, to me, watching this movie, I see this character, Bobby, as somebody who is flawed, yes, but also somebody who's very cool. And I think Jack Nicholson sort of lets that flow in a lot of different ways.
Which is why I particularly wanted you to watch Easy Rider before this, because Nicholson, this is the start of Nicholson as an actor. Nicholson in Easy Rider is kind of hilarious. He's a stiff suit who puts on a football helmet and climbs on the back of somebody else's motorcycle. He is not cool. He is kind of a nerd and a failure. And I think it's very difficult not to watch this movie and see the Jack that he becomes. Like, this is obviously the prototypical star vehicle for him. Yeah. There's that insane scene where he's just angry at a traffic jam.
Yeah.
And gets out of the car, and a dog barks at him, and he barks back at the dog.
Well, we all line up like a goddamn bunch of ass, the most beautiful part of the day in gas, Arthur.
In this manic, aggressive thing, and then gets on a truck and plays the piano.
He's absolutely brilliant. Like, yeah, that is like, it's like a pivotal, it is the pivotal scene in the movie for me.
And all of those things are in character with the sort of stuff that he would do in the next 50 years of his career.
Let's take it to The Shining, because I thought a lot about that movie when I was watching this. I like that that's a similar era.
Where for me, the touchstone role, well, the touchstone role for me is Batman 1989, Jack Nicholson as Joker. But the movie I love, the Jack Nicholson movie I love the most in my life is definitely One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest from 1975.
Yes. And also,
That knife's edge of could do harm to himself or others, is trying to be a good guy but cares more about himself than anybody else. That's the core of that character, and that's the core of this character.
Yeah, a wonderful opportunity to see Jack Nicholson playing Jack Nicholson. No, more than that.
but to see Jack Nicholson embody the essence that therefore went on to be the thing that people kept trying to tap back into, and to know that this film happened after years, literally 10 15 years of him trying to get movies and not being cast as something that reflected that this was a vehicle for him that transformed him and therefore all of our lives. Because, like, think about the number of people on this planet who know who Jack Nicholson is, but that have seen him in something. It's almost impossible to not have an understanding of Jack Nicholson.
I would like to bring our conversation to Sally Struthers.
Who is well known in local parts for always doing professional theater in Agonquit, Maine. Played Mrs. Hannigan in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, in a revival of Annie, before she broke her leg and had to get replaced.
Oh, no.
And who I literally only know from the Gilmore Girls. But who is dearly beloved from having been in All in the Family for however many seasons that was, and who hits on Jack Nicholson in the bowling alley.
My name's Shirley, but they call me Betty, and her name's Twinkie.
Yeah, and goes on to have some other scenes as well.
Has a wild, single-cut, massively weirdly choreographed orgasm scene.
It was epic. Yeah, she also has this really incredible scene where she's... So Bobby, the main character, and his friend Elton are having a dalliance with the two girls from the bowling alley, including Sally Struthers. And sort of like in the middle of this party where they're sort of drinking and smoking and whatever else, Sally Struthers' character, Betty, tells a story about the dimple on her chin and how her mom tells her this when she's really little. Like,
when you're born, you go on the assembly line past God, and if he likes you, he says you cute little thing and you get dimples there, and if he doesn't like you, he goes, go away.
And so when she's saying her prayers at night, she covers up the dimple on her chin so that God will listen to her.
And this is like a 30-second story in the middle of a scene of two topless men and two women in bras and panties singing a nursery rhyme and pretending to ride on a hobby horse while drinking in a scummy apartment. And then the tone shifts as she tells this incredible story about how she hates herself because of this story that her mom told her that God himself thinks that she's terrible and needs to be rejected.
Right. And then Jack Nicholson laughs, and then they go back to singing this nursery rhyme. Mm-hmm. And it's, to me, especially since I went back to start rewatching the movie. I didn't get all the way through the second time, but that moment and her delivery and that dynamic to me was one of the most raw, real portrayals of the feeling of what it is to struggle or suffer, but to not have anywhere to go with it. Like the reason why Rayette doesn't have the intellectual capacity to think or talk in like a more complex way is because there's no space for it. You drink it away. You sing it away, you know, like you just pass the joint, you know, like it all gets like swept away. But in that moment, it was just like such a, oh, I mean, still like I'm having a hard time finding the words because it was such a, I mean, for a director to put that in a movie, it was such a choice, you know, like we were talking mm-hmm. about before about like directors and choices, like to have her tell that story and to have them like start singing and laughing immediately afterwards. Like to give a female character that voice and that story and that moment, and then to take it away immediately afterwards. I don't think it was a mistake. And I think the screenwriter also is the story writer and the screenwriter also is a woman. They were co-writing it together.
Key point here. And
please.
I did a mildly deep dive into the screenwriter because please. I found her kind of fascinating in that she's a bit of an enigma. I first started researching her because I discovered that in one of the extras on the Blu-ray, Rafelson says that he believed that the reason why Eastman used a pseudonym of Adrienne Joyce on the picture was because she was unhappy with it.
Oh, so
that
interesting.
That he made some choices and changed some things on the script, and that he believed that this must have been something that made her sufficiently dissatisfied with what he'd done to her script that she took her name off it.
So interesting.
Except for the fact that she had used the name Adrienne Joyce when she wrote The Shooting.
Huh.
She used it a couple of times more, but Rafelson thought it was about him. And so that's when I first started to be like, I want to know what's going on with
yeah.
Eastman. And then there are a couple of lines about Eastman in Biskin's Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, where she's this enigmatic presence. I believe she died in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I found two different versions of the script online,
mm-hmm.
earlier drafts from the movie. So
lot
of my notes on this are things that were changed from earlier versions of the script to when it came out in the final form online. And for example, the ending was completely different.
What was the ending originally? What? You've been holding out on me.
The second to last scene after they've said goodbye to his sister and gotten in the car, and there's this scene where Karen Allen is singing, and Karen Allen has a gorgeous voice. The two different times that she's singing Tammy Wynette songs in the car, I really got this strong feeling that that was part of the reason why Nicholson liked and loved her,
yeah.
was that as a person who was brought up on music, even if he didn't like what she was singing, it was clear that she was really good at singing, even though she didn't really know what she was doing. And there was this interesting relationship there. And I think that's all subtext, because it's never actually talked about.
We can speculate, yeah.
And she's singing, "Don't touch me," I believe are the lyrics. And every time she sings it, she kisses him. And he's getting more and more annoyed.
Mm.
And I had this incredibly strong feeling that something was going to go horribly wrong. Did you have a similar impression during that
it
scene?
It did, yeah. That's interesting.
Like, it felt like there was something
like a tension building. Yeah, 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 totally.
That was supposed to cause them to go into an accident and go off the road. And he was going to die.
What?
The car was going to go and get buried in mud. She would cry him out. He wouldn't. And the last line of the film was originally intended to be, she stands on the side of the road, notices that he has not saved himself, and says, "You son of a bitch," and walks away. Rafelson said, "It makes it seem like Jack's character has a death wish, and I don't want that to be the read on his, that he's not running away from something. He doesn't sit down in front of his father and say, I'm always running away, I'm always leaving things behind, so much so that he's going to leave his life behind."
Interesting.
In part because, as we see in that New Yorker article, he likes that character. He doesn't want him dead. He wants him, even if he's not ready to be saved, he wants him still potentially in the future to maybe be able to be saved.
Also, that would be very melodramatic.
So, Eastman also didn't write the scene with Sally Struthers.
Interesting.
That came about in part because of on-set improv. And Rafelson doesn't know where that story came from.
What?
But it seems pretty clear, therefore, that Struthers had probably heard that story herself at some point in her life.
I love it. Oh my gosh, it's so good. Can I read this part of this review that I found?
Please.
It's written by Scott Nye, who is not my friend. I say that because I'm not pleased with this review. And this one just, it stood out to me so much that I was like thinking about it days later, like mad about it. And so I had to, go find it.
So we're calling you out, Nye.
Says, and there's that heartbreaking story Betty, Sally Struthers, tells about how her mother told her that God probably didn't want her. Fodder for many a moment of self-examination in the dark if she wasn't busy bouncing up and down on some guy's lap.
Which isn't true.
And I feel like it does this incredible disservice to not only that moment, but also to many of the moments in the movie which feature incredibly well-written female characters. Mm-hmm. And if I can follow it up with another review that I read.
Anna, you are co-host of this podcast. You can do anything you want.
So this is from a person called Roger Ebert. In this particular excerpt, I realized that I'm also not friends with Roger Ebert. He says, Dupin discovers his girl is pregnant. His friend Elton breaks the news out in the field, suggesting maybe it would be good to marry her and settle down. He walks out in a rage, has a meaningless little affair with a slut from the bowling alley, and then discovers more or less by accident that his father is dying. This review hurts me.
Let's move on to your least favorite part of the program, where I'm going to have you...
No!
Watch an excerpted minute from the film.
Okay.
Give us a summary in under 30 seconds of what happens in the film, and then try and answer 5 trivia questions related to the content in some obscure,
oh my God,
and terrifying way.
Okay, let's do it.
Generated by random.org and is going to watch minute number 54 of the movie.
Okay.
So here we go. Minute 54.
Oh my God.
All right, Anna, your 30 seconds starts now.
All right, so Bobby is in the living room of the house where he grew up. He's like looking around. There's what I assume is a maybe like a Chopin piece playing, a piano, 2 pianos playing. He walks over to the door where the music is coming from. He pushes it open. He looks through like first the crack of the door and then around the edge of the door.
10 seconds left.
And then he sees like his brother with a neck brace and then his
5 seconds left.
His brother's girlfriend, and they're both playing the piano together. It's a duet.
Finished with 2 seconds to spare.
It's not first. Usually I'm like way, way behind.
Yes, but the good people at random.org provided you with a 60-second scene with no dialogue of Jack Nicholson walking through an empty room.
I know, and I gotta just clarify for everyone, it's not funny the first time you see it. Maybe, actually, I think it probably is. I didn't think it was funny because I was just so confused.
Well, we have been told by his sister that because he's been in this accident that he has to wear the neck brace, and she keeps on laughing while she's telling this story despite the fact that this is a permanent injury, and she feels bad about making fun of it. It's one of the ways in which... First of all, I just like to say, the actress that plays his sister...
Lois Smith.
Yes, is so fantastic. Like, they have such good brother-sister chemistry.
She's
it's
incredible.
Good physical casting.
Yes.
Her emotional range, the way in which that she is able to play, the kind of unconscious competition. Oh, boy, is she extraordinary. And the two of them with each other are extraordinary in those scenes. But yes, we don't know necessarily who those are, except that when the door cracked open and I saw, I was like, oh, that's the people that she's told us about in the scene earlier. Oh,
fair enough.
Yeah. It's such an odd movie because the first, I mean, maybe it's partly not really knowing at all what the movie was about when I started. I had literally no idea that he was a piano player when I watched this movie. So the scene where he gets onto the back of the truck and starts playing the piano incredibly well, like a complicated classical piece, was a shock, a delight. But then the point where he returns home and the movie completely shifts in tone, when he goes home, it becomes this almost like absurdist farce, if you will, to where things are more lighthearted. There's a quippy back and forth. You know, there's like a scene with the sister and the nurse in the sister's room that everyone should just enjoy for themselves. It's like this so unexpected in terms of a shift in tone.
And a very specific changes in tones. It becomes a bit of a road movie. We have what I consider to be an extremely deliberate editing choice that creates a sense of comedy, where you have the the character of Palm going on and on about the dirtiness and the filth and the difference between dirt and filth and how much she hates it. And then she keeps on saying,
I don't even want to talk about it.
And then cuts to the car zooming past the camera and a little bit of country music going, and then she keeps talking about it. Like, they do it three times in a row. It might as well be a scene from Laugh-In. It's so much the product of a man who directed and created The Monkees. It made me so happy. But also, once we get off the road, we get away from Tammy Wynette. We've had four songs by Tammy Wynette in the soundtrack. And then the soundtrack becomes classical piano for the second half of the movie, with one exception where Nicholson gets so mad at when Rayette has come and visited his house that he gets on the ferry, goes back to the mainland, gets in a bar, falls asleep drunk on a wharf listening to Tammy Wynette again. But the movie is very clearly musically delineated between five pieces, five songs by Tammy Wynette, and five piano pieces in the second half of the movie. So let's ask you some terrible, unanswerable trivia questions about the classical music that appears in this scene.
Okay, I can do it.
So, the piece that Catherine and Bobby's brother were playing is the Piano Concerto No. 9 in E-flat major by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. This piece is commonly known as Jeune Homme, French for young man, because A. Because Mozart had believed that the gallant, light touch required to play this was only able to be achieved by the skill of young performers, and old established performers were so outmoded they wouldn't be able to play it. B. It was written for a young pianist that Mozart had met, and which musicologists believed was a young man, but in actuality was a young woman named Victoria Genneman. Or C, Mozart wrote the piece when he was 21, and it was a deliberate statement that said that he had moved past the over 250 pieces he'd previously composed as a young man.
In B, the person's name is Mrs. Youngman, Ms. Youngman?
It's not quite, no, it's not Victoria Genome, it's Victoria Genome.
I'm gonna go with C.
It was B.
God, every time.
Question number two. The concerto was written in 1777, Beethoven's Symphony No. 3 in E-flat major, Beethoven's Eroica, followed in 1804, and is generally considered to be a revolution in classical music. Why is this important? A certain person said that this piano concerto is Mozart's Eroica. The person that said this and made the comparison was A, Albert Einstein, B, John F. Kennedy, C, James Joyce.
These are not possible to know.
Correct. These are all random shots in the dark.
C.
James Joyce.
Yes.
I'm sorry, it was B. Albert Einstein.
What? No!
Albert Einstein had apparently very strong opinions about the fact that this was the most important piece that Mozart had written and deserved to be credited as such.
But that's wrong.
Why is this important? because Jack Nicholson's character's middle name is Eroica.
Yeah.
And so the piece that they're playing when he walks in the room is, coincidentally enough, Mozart's Eroica.
I'm sure it's not a coincidence, Ben.
No, I'm sure it isn't. But let's not talk about Mozart for a minute. Since we're talking about the Eroica,
let's move on.
Let's switch to Beethoven. Beethoven, when he composed his symphony in E-flat major, dedicated it to a key person and then scribbled the name off it in anger and distaste when he was told something about the person.
Oh, it sounds like something I would do. You're like, sorry, Ebert.
Which of these three people was the Eroica originally dedicated to and his name was removed? A. Lord Byron, when Beethoven discovered that he'd killed his neighbor in a duel and fled to Belgium to escape prosecution. B. Victor Hugo, when Beethoven discovered that he spoke out against Napoleon and was exiled from France to Brussels accordingly. Or C. Napoleon himself, when he discovered that Napoleon had declared himself emperor, which Beethoven felt made him just another tyrant.
B.
Which is?
You say it.
I think you're just guessing letters.
Because every time I think it's like a thing, I get it wrong. I thought it was Napoleon, but then...
Correct, it was Napoleon.
Oh, really? I was like, every time I say the thing, I think I get it wrong.
Trust yourself. Trust women, Anna.
No, no. You could make these a little easier, you know.
You're right. I could give you two very obvious wrong answers and one that sounds vaguely close.
No, that's not what I mean. All right.
Beethoven's Eroica has a history as funereal music, as it's used to commemorate those who are thought of as great heroes. Who was not memorialized with a public performance of Eroica after their death? A. It was played at the funeral of the 11 athletes killed at the Olympic bombing in Munich in 1972. B. F. Scott Fitzgerald had it playing on his deathbed so that he would die listening to it. Or C. It was played in St. Paul's Cathedral in London for the public funeral of Winston Churchill. Which of those is not true?
I think B.
F. Scott Fitzgerald definitely died listening to that music. In 1940. Lastly, the publisher...
Wait, so what was the right answer?
The right answer was Winston Churchill was buried after a three-day funeral to a series of his favorite hymns, including, you know, stuff from church, but not Beethoven.
Stuff from church.
I thought I was going to remember the name of the key one that was listed in the article, and then my brain said, it's probably nearer my God to thee, but that might be wrong, so I just decided to go with a vague generalization.
Stuff from church. Yeah, no,
stuff from church. You know it. Hymns. It's the very definition of stuff from church. Number five. The music publisher Naxos has a database of classical music that's used in films. Of the five pieces that are used in Five Easy Pieces, they only list two. So we know it's a very incomplete database. However, they claim that Beethoven's Eroica has only been used in four films. Which of these is not one of those films? This Is My Life from 1992, the directorial debut of Nora Ephron about a woman who wants to be a stand-up comic, Immortal Beloved from 1994 with Gary Oldman playing Beethoven, The Girl from 2012, a story about Alfred Hitchcock's tempestuous relationship with Tippi Hedren, or Mission Impossible Rogue Nation from 2015, where an assassin is at the opera.
Hey.
Unfortunately, it was The Girl. The piece was used in 2012's Hitchcock, but not the made-for-TV movie about Hitchcock called The Girl.
You gotta make these easier because it's not gonna be fun for people to listen to me just, like, lose brutally.
Well, I was so caught up in the minutiae of trying to read my own handwriting, I didn't keep track of what you got right or wrong, so as far as I'm concerned, you did great.
Thanks. What do I win?
I don't know. You win the right to decide whether or not you make the quiz next episode.
Yes, I will make the quiz next episode.
All right. At this point in the program, Anna, we usually move on to a list of our five favorite moments. Brief things, tiny pieces of actor or writing or performance or photography that just made us think or smile or enjoy ourselves. Do you have a couple of moments that you want to contribute to the conversation?
I do. I think we've talked about some of them at length already.
For example?
I think, you know, the scene with Sally Struthers talking about her chin really stood out to me so specifically. I can't wait to go watch it again, actually.
I'm going to say that most of my favorite moments were involved in the two hitchhikers in the car. I found them to be an extraordinary performance and just a really bright spot in the middle. I loved how aggressive they were, but also how strange their relationship was. And one of the things that particularly got to me was when they first meet them on the side of the road, Palm angrily says,
"Look at my car. I just bought it brand new from the used car lot, and the steering goes to part of me."
And that she wants to go back and yell at the guy for selling her something totally faulty. And then she hands Jack a sewing machine and says, back to her friend, Terry Gross, "We found a ride." I similarly love the fact that she can't remember the word for steam.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
And she's in the back and she's talking about, yeah, man, yeah.
"You know, I read where they invented this car that runs on, when you boil water. Steam."
yeah, that's it. And her whole angry vibe and her inability to shut up just really knocked me for a loop. I just sat there cackling for the whole 10 minutes that they were on screen. What was another moment for you?
It's not a single moment, but I loved some of the beautiful scenes where Bobby's walking around the city, and we see like these different moments where he's like walking by the laundromat, and like eventually he walks into the diner where Raya works. Those scenes were like some of those like beautiful Americana moments where like you definitely feel like the Edward Hopper, like that sense of loneliness. And I don't know if it's the cinematographer, the director of photography, or if that role is the same on movies. What is his name?
Laszlo Kovacs.
Yes. If he would have been like responsible for some of those designs of those shots, but I felt very fond of them.
I would say that for my moment number four, the thing that really struck me was in the table tennis scene. There were a lot of little moments in this film that jumped out at me from a contemporary perspective. I particularly liked when Tita talks about how she's able to understand a wealth of approval or disapproval just in the eyes of her father, which I think is an important skill to have when everyone's wearing masks. But I particularly liked that Carl has the brazen ego to tie a cravat around his neck brace in order to play table tennis.
You gotta keep it classy.
Gotta keep it classy. He's about to get on the car, to get on the ferry, to go to the island, to get hydrotherapy for his neck. And he can't do that just looking like a schmo. He's gotta represent. And so he has picked out a tie and wrapped it around his foam rubber neck brace in order to lose 21-2 to his brother on table tennis. Do you have a last moment that you want to bring up?
Well, it's a little well-trodden, but I really have to say that the piano scene where Jack Nicholson's character gets out of the car that he's in, they're on their way to work in the traffic jam, and he gets onto the back of the truck that's in front of them in the traffic jam, and he pulls the cover off of this piano that's in the truck. And you sort of feel it coming because you see the piano on the truck, but it takes a few seconds to unfold. Then, like, sitting down and playing this like beautiful piano piece on the piano.
And, like, on a piano that's badly tuned and not making a good sound, and you sort of hear it over the rumbling of the other cars around it. It's a really interesting sound mix. I love the fact that you keep on referring to this as beautifully played.
I think it's because I didn't know. I knew that, so all I knew going into the movie is that he was a musician. I didn't know that he was, and so I thought he was like a rocker or something, and he was like giving up his rock and roll band, you know, because that's more the cliche of like, oh, I was a rocker and now I'm not because I have this, you know, baby and I gotta work on the oil rig, you know, which is like a little bit where the movie goes, except it sort of turns that all on its ear because he's a classical pianist, you know. It's like this very strange and unexpected part of the movie. And so, and then the truck pulls off the exit and he stays on and he's just like completely enveloped in this moment of playing on the piano. And I think it's this wonderful crossroads of how he still really loves this thing that he's given up, and he's an absolute maniac as a human being, and and that he's unhinged, and the whole movie is unhinged, you know. And it's like it's a really chaotic scene that's absolutely wonderful and fun, especially if you don't see it coming. I don't know how it is, like, if you know exactly kind of what's going down. But I loved it, and it doesn't sort of arrive for like a little ways into the movie too. So you sort of
I think it's 18 minutes in, if I'm not mistaken.
I have 20, but
yeah. But you're right. And at this point, the film has been entirely about the abusive / romantic tensions in the couples, and so we haven't known where necessarily the film's going, except potentially as a kitchen sink explosion of terrible domestic desperation. And so this is the first moment that it's showing us that it's going to go someplace else.
Yeah.
Interesting that this is the when you first started to say, well, of course, we haven't talked about the piano scene, I thought you were going to talk about his performance of the piano in front of Catherine.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about it. I mean, we've talked about Catherine like barely at all, which is too bad, because I think that she's a very important and awesome character.
Well, one of the key things about the film, in my opinion, is structurally that we don't understand that Jack is a man who is refined until he puts on that suit and visits his sister in the recording studio, and then we start to understand. We have a couple lines of dialogue where Rayette says,
"You can play on the piano and your whole damn family can play on some type of musical instrument. And all I'm asking is for you to help me improve my musical talent."
But it's brushed off very quickly and never really referred to again until we get that 18 to 20 minute piano moment where you start to understand that there's something else going on. Mm-hmm. The film originally started with a long, slow pan of photographs of them performing, of Jack as a young boy at age 8 at a recital, playing with his mother in a duet, of showing us a performance piece of a book called Five Easy Pieces, which is what the title comes from, and then him stalking out of his mother's funeral before then cutting to the oil fields at Bakersfield. So the movie originally was intended to start with us being very aware that Jack was purposely pretending to be lower class. And by removing that and putting it instead in this scene with Catherine, where he's playing the Chopin, the camera wanders through the room and shows us the photographs and the programs and the portraits of the famous musicians that his parents hung there as inspiration for them, and their photographs among them, and the pressure of saying, we want you to be as good as these other musicians of these professional symphonies, of these major musicologists. And then it cuts back at the very end, and no cuts involved. In fact, it pans back to Catherine watching and being emotionally moved by this, and Nicholson saying,
"I picked the easiest piece that I could think of, and I first played it when I was 8 years old, and I played it better then."
He's trying to seduce her. He's deliberately trying to do something that will move her to be attracted to him. And he can't help himself. He still says, "Your value systems are terrible, lady, if you thought that that was any good. I can't believe you fell for that. That was garbage."
Interesting.
He wants to get in her pants, but he can't even do it as a lie. Can't even lie to her about it to do it.
I see it also, though, as like another symptom of like his inability to emotionally be authentic with other people, because I don't think that he's being honest when he says that. I think that in some ways he is, but I also think it's this like this aspect of self-loathing where he's like, I could have done it better when I was 8. Like, this is super easy. Like, he's putting himself down and he's putting up this wall. Like, she's trying to praise him. He's pushing her away. It's just, it's part of this, like, inability to accept, like, closeness and praise. He's a bundle of, you know, pulling people towards him. You know, he wants to have an affair with this person, pushing people away simultaneously. He's insulting her for the exact thing that he's trying to use her to get to come towards him with, you know. So yeah. I just think he's really unhealthy, but yes. And she says that directly to him, you know, and she is one of the most like solid grounded characters I think in the movie, where she's able to like speak directly towards him about exactly this issue, which is like, I can't be with somebody who doesn't, you know, care for themselves. And I think that that moment is really like, whether or not it was the easiest piece and whether or not he did feel emotion, I think that she's right to have the reaction that she does, which is to like kind of recoil and be like, whoa, like whatever you're up to, this is not what healthy looks like. Like, we're not going anywhere, you know.
Which, again, the script gives us in advance that that's what's going to happen. And if we could have a sixth little moment, I would claim that this one, which is they're lying in bed together and she's telling him her origin story about how she got her first divorce. And she's so proud when she says,
and I said to him, Joseph, you're full of beans. And I left him.
And it's such a weirdly quaint thing to be proud of saying to somebody. Yeah. Like, she doesn't say, Joseph, screw you and the horse you ran it on. Yeah. She doesn't go for broke. She's sort of goofy and colloquial, and you know, she's definitely European of some sort. Her accent's a little weird. Her, you know, her Dutch character's last name. So maybe that's a literal translation, or maybe that's her command of English. Whatever it is, it's so cute. But at the same time, she's saying, I'm not going to put up with a guy that's full of crap.
Yeah.
And so she's letting us know that even though the character of Bobby has decided that she's his hope for trying to figure out what's going on with him, that that's not true, that he's full of beans.
This is good, Ben. This has been very therapeutic for me.
Farced Perspective was created and developed by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. This episode was researched, recorded, and produced by the presenters. Editing by Ben Russell. Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song was mixed from recordings of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, sourced by Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community. You can find us at farcedperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at farcednamebasis. If there are things, facts, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website. We will post it to our errata page on Farce Perspective as soon as possible. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of comic phenomenon, and our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Ben, my co-host is Anna, and we'll see you next time when we discuss another comic touchstone celebrating a key anniversary.